economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations, and finally the Soviet Union began to go and down in technological competition, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, each this according to the Arrighi studies, each one-century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new, more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production, in the real sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the real sector simply doesn't matter. During the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, the amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which have much more complicated structure, which combine the central strategic planning with the market competition mechanism. The government control the money circulation through the government, through the state banking system. And at the same time, the private entrepreneurs, the private companies has access to the endless credit facilities, but they get this access only in those spheres which increase the production of the goods which have consumer demand. So this combination of central strategic planning and private markets and companies' competition gives new opportunities for the economic growth. The government creates, the central bank, government central bank create money. The government controls the circulation of this money. It's due in such a way to avoid the speculations. They give opportunity to the private companies have a long-term credit, maybe half, 0.5 interest rate, even 0.2 interest rates, which are provided by the government banks for those companies which are able to produce more goods and give more opportunities for economic growth. And the government at the same time block the speculations which undermine the economic stability. For this reason, almost all money which are created by the state are going to the real sector. And today we see that monetization of the Chinese economy about two times higher than American economies. Almost the amount of money which were created by the Chinese state bank during the last 12 years increased about three times. But this money was not going to the financial speculations as in the United States. It was going to the production sector. And we see that Chinese corporations like Huawei, let's say, or Xiaomi, or China Construction, or Power Engineering Company, becomes the huge built corporations. They were created, especially in private sector, like Huawei or Xiaomi, they were created just from nothing, from private cooperatives, which are growing up very fast because the government support these companies with the cheap credits. But at the same time, the government control with the use of the money. It's avoid the capital flight. The currency control is very strong. The yuan, RMB, is convertible only for current transactions, for trade, but it is not convertible for the capital transactions. The capital flows are controlled by the government, and all this monetary mechanism is designed in such a way to promote investments. You see, the Chinese, as well as Indian and maybe Iranian financial system, has a clear goal to finance, first of all, new investments, to finance the growth of production, which is quite different from the American and Western system, where the money are created for the needs of the financial oligarchs. They print money in huge quantities without taking care where this money are going. The main idea to get super profits. For this reason, they create various derivatives, which in fact are pure speculative instruments. And these financial bubbles concentrate about 80% of the whole money created by the Federal Reserve. And the mechanism which we see at the moment in the West, financial mechanism, is going through the turbulence. It becomes very turbulent. Every 10 years, we have the financial crisis. And there is completely, almost no economic growth. There is no growth of the real income of the population. So American and European economy is in stagnation. At the same time, the Chinese and Indian economies are growing up very fast. So the world economy is switched to the new center in the South East Asia. We see the new world economic center, which dominates now in the world economy by the growth rates. More than 50% of the growth of the world economy is the growth in those Asian countries. This center is much more efficient. It wins economic competition. And the Pax Americana is going to the end, not because Chinese and Indian economies are growing up so fast, not because they were in miserable situation before. They're growing up very fast because they have much more efficient system of management, much more efficient institutional system. So this new type of economic organization combines the central planning for central strategic planning and private entrepreneurs. We call this type of state as integrated, integrative state, or integrated world economic mode, because the main function of the state is the combination of the interests, the harmonization of the interests of various social groups. The American-style system is designed for the needs of the financial oligarchy. The American system protects property rights for the large capital, and they don't care about the workers, about the population as a whole. And for this reason, we see the huge social differentiation, which finally go into the political destabilization, which we have seen during the last presidential elections in the United States. As for the new type of the state in Asia, we see the socialist ideology. We see the huge role of the moral standards. The state is responsible before the people. The main idea of the economic policy is the growth of the incomes and living standards of the population. So this combination of the socialist ideology, of the traditional values, of market mechanism and central strategic planning, government control over the money creation, shows the huge efficiency, and it is no doubt that the last part of the present century will be dominated by the competition between China and India. Unfortunately, cost about 100 million people killed in the two world wars organized by the British Empire. And now the American financial and ruling elite is trying to maintain its leadership, starting the new world war. We call this war hybrid war, because the main front lines in this war are going in the financial sector, in the economic and trade sector, in information technologies, and only the final stage, they use the military power in order to press opposition and in order to finalize the expansion in the financial and economic and information sectors. But this is the real world war, because the idea of this world war, hybrid world war, is from the American side, is to maintain its world hegemony. And they don't care about other countries. Those countries which are not controlled by the United States are going through the culture, through the color revolutions. Exactly. The American Americans are trying to undermine political stability. In those countries which they do not have control, they introduce various methods for chaotization of those countries. They provoke wars between countries. The main idea of them was to provoke the war between Russia and China. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Now the Russia and China have strategic partnership. And because the China is too large now, and American lose the economic competition with China, they're trying now to press Russia, to undermine Russia, to destroy Russia, in order to improve its position in the world by means of controlling the Russia natural resources and to prevent the growth of China. So American plan today has three stages. The first one, to destroy Russia, because, you know, the Russophobia is one of the long-term, have deep roots in Anglo-Saxon geopolitics.
Exactly.
The whole geopolitics theory of the 19th century, designed by the English and Germans, was the some quasi-science how to destroy the Russian Empire. It was the main headache of the Western geopoliticians to find methods how to destroy Russian Empire. And the Ukrainian crisis, the war today in Ukraine, happened according to the recommendations of their geopolitical theory, starting from Bismarck and then following with Brzezinski. They stressed a lot of times that in order to destroy Russia, first of all, you have to get away Ukraine from Russia. Because the formula of Brzezinski was that Russia without Ukraine couldn't be the superpower. And all this Russophobia, which was have deep roots in the Anglo-Saxon geopolitics, now played a key role. Why the United States use Russia as the main goal, to maintain the world hegemony. And Ukrainian provocation was prepared on the systemic basis during the 20 years, especially the last 8 years. They trying to control Ukraine. As you know, they organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. The Ukraine during the last 8 years do not have independent government. This territory is totally controlled by the CIA and other American and British organizations. And the first stage for them is of this hybrid war. In fact, hybrid war began with the sanctions against Russia in 2014. And then the second stage was the economic war with China, where the American used the same methods as the British Empire used in the 30s, when British Empire prevented the access of American goods to their empire in order to get more compatible position in comparison with the United States. Now the United States did the same. They launched the trade war with China in order to maintain their markets and in order to limit the growth of China, but they failed in this war. Nowadays, they used sanctions against Russia. They intervene, in fact, in Russia military and cultural space. They are trying to destroy Russia with various information technologies and trying to use to provoke the war in Ukraine in order to undermine the Russian government. They want to chaotize Russia. And second, they want to destroy Iran. They do this. They're trying to do this permanently during the last 20 years. And their final goal is China, taking control over Russia and Iran. American ruling elite thinks that they can deal with China on the.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
As a reminder, it was said that the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was forced to leave Turkey for Iraq. It was also said that after 1 month of staying in the holy city of Najaf, the Imam's family joined him except Ahmad, Imam Khomeini's youngest son. Today we're going to continue with our story. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued enlightening and awakening the Iranian people through secret liaison with ulama or religious scholars and young seminary students. He didn't give up, lay bare the betrayals of the despotic Pahlavi regime. His steadfast wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, says, "Once we were in Karbala, the Imam was writing a statement. Mustafa asked, 'What are you writing?' The Imam replied, 'I wrote and sent it to Qom yesterday.' He wouldn't let anyone, even his eldest son Mustafa, be informed of writing statements. Not that Mustafa was a stranger, rather, he used to decide alone. We went to the yard. I asked, 'Were you writing a statement?' He laughed and said, 'What about it?' I said, 'I don't say that they will arrest you, but they will increase pressure on your friends in Iran.' He didn't say anything. I said, 'In my opinion, it is the time of private letters. First make the morale of those who are interested in these issues and then release official statements.' He just looked at me. I said, 'When they had taken you, I realized many things from the wives of the ulama and understood that they are not ready for such words. understood that if they sometimes keep silent or express inclination, it is out of expediency. He looked at me again and didn't say anything. When I was leaving, he said, "What about people, the wives of grocers, masons, and seminary students?" I looked at him and kept silent. However, my words were not ineffective because during 15 years, the imam's basic job was to have relation with the ulama whom he knew that they were the men of struggle. Imam Khomeini's stay in the holy city of Najaf coincided with frosty relations between Iran and Iraq. Thus, many Iranians were expelled from Iraq in those days, and they were denied permission to enter Iraq. Under these tense conditions, many Iranian ulama or religious scholars in Iraq didn't intend to criticize the Iraqi regime. But Imam Khomeini expressly and bravely castigated the Iraqi president and protested at him via telegraph. His wife relates the account. As the Iran-Iraq relations were severed, Iranians were expelled from the country. Baathist expelled the Iranians living in Najaf, in Karbala, and in other Iraqi cities for years. It was heartrending. They would pour into the houses of people and plunder their belongings. The imam strongly protested against these conditions and sent a telegraph to the Iraqi president, Hassan al-Bakr, whereby he had rebuked al-Bakr harshly. Imam Khomeini was the only scholar in the city of Najaf to protest. He called them worse than the Shah. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini's wife accompanied him in all tough conditions and didn't accept to leave Iraq. Therefore, the imam appreciated their efforts by calling her as the follower of the Prophet's wife, Lady Khadija, peace be upon her. During Imam Khomeini's exile in the city of Najaf, he and his family would go to Karbala on special occasions, such as Ashura Arba'in, the 40th day of Imam Hussein's martyrdom, or 13th of Rajab, or 15th of Sha'ban, the Eid al-Fitr, and the Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. However, it was very interesting that while even ordinary seminary students would take cars from Najaf to Karbala, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, as a great source of emulation, would never take a car and would always travel by bus. The imam's wife recounts this. "We used to go to Karbala nearly six times a year. The imam and Mustafa would go together, but I and Mustafa's wife would go with children. We all would go by bus. One day, Mustafa's wife told me, 'You come short that you do not take a car for us.' I was very upset. The next trip, I was not satisfied with going to Karbala, as children had been hurt a lot in the almost 60-degree temperatures of the summer. I related this story to say that the imam would treat us so toughly, although, as a source of emulation, he had a huge amount of money. This was because he wanted not to transgress the framework which he had determined for himself." During his stay in the city of Najaf, Imam Khomeini was not allowed to enter Iran. In those days, his youngest son, Ahmad, got married, and the imam couldn't take part in the wedding ceremony and other ceremonies. Imam Khomeini wrote in his letter to Haj Ahmad, "Dear Ahmad, inshallah, this marriage will be blessed for you and the respectable lady, and may you spend long years together with health and joy. Whenever I go to the shrine of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, I will pray for you. Inshallah, it will be answered. Then he wrote to his daughter-in-law, I'm happy that Ahmad has married with a genuine and respectable family. Inshallah, God willing, you will be happy, blissful and successful with the blessing of your pure ancestors. Inshallah, God willing, this marriage will be happy, blessed and full of success and bliss of the world and the hereafter. Thank the Almighty, you have inherited the lofty merits of your great father, paternal ancestors and venerated mother and maternal ancestors. I hope that, inshallah, God willing, Ahmad will also enjoy these merits. I will not forget praying for you.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Gaza was flashed bright by explosions as Israeli artillery and other weapons targeted what they say were weapons factories and rocket launch sites belonging to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Following the latest round of aggression initiated by the Israeli military, an aerial duel was also held as rockets were fired from Gaza towards Israel, some intercepted by the Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system, yet many penetrated deep inside Israel, reaching as far as Tel Aviv. Earlier, in a televised address, the Israeli Prime Minister said the regime had zero tolerance for attacks from Gaza and that isn't interested in a wider conflict in Gaza but will not shy away from one either. Israel has labeled the latest round of aggression as a preemptive operation. It says it aimed to thwart alleged planned rocket attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the initial Israeli bombardment a declaration of war, firing a barrage of at least 100 rockets into southern Israel. Around 13 people were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. Some reports have, however, indicated that many Israelis were killed in the retaliatory attacks. In response to the Israeli aggression, the Al-Quds brigades launched attacks on cities across the occupied territories. Hamas also announced its support for the Islamic Jihad and said it would respond to the strikes. Israel claims it targets military sites, but similar to all other attacks by the regime, civilians seem to be on the receiving end of the rockets.
Definitely, this is a war crime. It's a war crime in itself. The bombing in itself is a war crime. The siege of Gaza and the blockade for 15 years is a war crime. The starving people, cutting off the electricity and cutting off the water supply and cutting off the ability for Palestinians to import much necessary food and building supplies and medicine and allow people to leave and come back is a war crime in itself. This is not acceptable. And that's one thing. The second aspect of it is that the fact that Israel has claimed and actually publicly announced that it is using this as a preemptive in itself is also a war crime because even in international law of war, you are supposed to respond in a proportionate manner if you are being attacked. Actually, even this time, Israel itself admitted that there has been no provocation. Israel has been provoking again and again and again and has been provoking the Palestinians in order to create a war with the Palestinians and in order to punish Palestinians again and again. So Palestinians have not done anything yet. And so Israel went and bombed and killed so many children, so many civilians, has destroyed again Gaza. This is apartheid. This is a crime against humanity.
The United States has time and again vowed to support Israel. This includes the U.S. President's latest trip to Israel, where he pledged full military support for Israel with regard to the Iron Dome, a new laser system, and other military support. And now regarding the latest round of attack against Gaza, the U.S. ambassador to the regime said Israel has a right to defend itself. That is a green light for Israel to continue with its rocket attacks. The UK Foreign Secretary also echoed similar remarks, adding that the kingdom stands by Israel.
Biden has continued support for Israel unconditionally. He repeated support for Israel and quote-unquote its security when it is not even threatened. It's the one that's threatening the security of the Palestinian people, including the children, women, elderly people, disabled, everybody. Israel is threatening the security. It's not the other way around. So for the United States to go around and for Joe Biden making so many promises during his campaign against Bush, against Trump, that he was going to roll back many of the aggressive actions of Trump, which were already before Trump, not really happily during Obama as well, and Joe Biden was his vice president. They were actually very problematic against the Palestinians. For Biden not to even reverse the steps, the aggressive steps that Trump has taken against the Palestinians, but to continue military aid, economic aid, collaboration with Israel, justification for Israel's attack on, it is giving a green light, and it is exactly the way we all understood it.
Those statements have, however, drawn criticism from the United Nations. The UN Special Reporter on the Occupied Palestinian Territories slammed the U.S. for the remarks and stated that Israel cannot claim that it is defending itself in this conflict. She also condemned the regime's attacks as illegal and irresponsible. Meanwhile, the office of the Palestinian president called this week's attack a dangerous escalation. The regime's attacks was also followed by a closure of two border crossings with the Gaza Strip. But Palestine has witnessed such acts of aggression from time and again, and the heaviest price is always paid by the civilians. The Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. That is 15 years of a blockade. Israel has also waged many wars against the Gaza Strip and killed scores of Palestinians, yet there's no mention of this, while Russia's war in Ukraine takes center stage on a daily basis.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assaults in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might. This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Interparliamentary. Since 1949, that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical, geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China. Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatist and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels
the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have, as part of its sort of thinking, that somebody is going to be our equal. We have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. You know, that's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine if the military display of China is anything to go by. The U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the U.S. has failed to create a united global front against Russia. the asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive, large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles. Military exercise zones have been identified surrounding the Taiwan island with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan island for 3 days, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the U.S. and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the US refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the US decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the U.S. formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the U.S. policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the U.S. government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification, but neither do they want independence, because independence will affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as China succeeded now in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The U.S. is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
water shortages across the European continent, from France through Italy, Spain and beyond, are creating a critical situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists John Henley, Stephen Bergen, Angela Giuffrida and Philip Alterman. The piece is titled "The New Normal: How Europe is Being Hit by a Climate-Driven Drought Crisis." Please stay with us for more. Europe's most severe drought in decades is hitting homes, factories, farmers, and freight across the continent, as experts warn drier winters and searing summers, fueled by global heating, mean water shortages will become the new normal in Europe. The European Union European Drought Observatory has calculated that 45% of the bloc's territory was under drought warning by mid-July, with 15% already on red alert, prompting the European Commission to warn of a critical situation in multiple regions. Conditions have deteriorated since, as repeated heat waves roll across the European continent. In France, the Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, last week activated a crisis unit to tackle a drought, Meteo France, described as the country's worst since records began in 1958. More than 100 French municipalities have no running drinking water and are being supplied by truck, Green Transition Minister Christophe Béchu said, adding, "We're going to have to get used to episodes of this type. Adaptation is no longer an option, it's an obligation." With surface soil humidity the lowest ever recorded in Europe, and July rainfall 85% lower than usual, water restrictions, including hosepipe and irrigation bans, are in place in 93 of France's 96 mainland departments, with 62 classified as in crisis. Amid rising food prices following the Russia-Ukraine conflict, France's agriculture minister warned the corn harvest is likely to be more than 18% lower than last year, while farmers' unions say a shortage of cattle fodder as a result of the drought could lead to significant milk shortages in the coming autumn and winter. The electricity utility EDF was last week forced to reduce output from one of its nuclear reactors in southwestern France because of high water temperatures in the Garonne River, and has issued multiple similar warnings for reactors along the Rhone. Spain's water reserves are at an all-time low of 40% and have been falling at a rate of 1.5% a week through a combination of increased consumption and evaporation, according to the Spanish government, in what is likely to be the driest of the past 60 years. The country has received less than half its expected rainfall for the time of year for the past 3 months, with restrictions in place from Catalonia in the northeast to Galicia in the northwest, as well as western Extremadura and Andalusia in the south. Most water restrictions have been imposed on domestic users in Spain, with rural authorities often reluctant to rein in farmers' frequently illegal exploitation of an increasingly scant resource, despite agriculture accounting for 9/10 of Spain's water consumption. A post-pandemic tourism revival has also led to a rise in consumption by as much as 10% in cities such as Barcelona, where, if there is no rainfall soon and none is forecast, restrictions are likely to be imposed next month. Climate change studies warn that droughts are going to be more intense and more frequent and longer said Nuria Hernandez Mora, the co-founder of the New Water Culture. This is going to be the new normal in Europe, and yet we continue to approve the increased use of a resource we don't have and which is becoming scarcer. This year is also said to become the hottest and driest ever year recorded in Italy. I don't know what we need to do any more to make the climate crisis a political theme, said Luca Mercalli, the president of the Italian Meteorological Society. No similar data in the last 230 years compares with the drought and the heat wave we're experiencing this year. Then we have had storms. These episodes are growing in frequency and intensity, exactly as forecast by climate reports over the last 30 years. Why do we continue to wait to make this a priority? One of the most prominent manifestations of the crisis is the parched River Po in northern Italy. The flow rate of Italy's longest waterway has fallen to one-tenth of the usual figure, while its water level is 2 meters below normal. The Italian government declared a drought emergency in 5 northern regions of Italy, rationing drinking water in early July. Villagers around Lake Maggiore are being supplied by truck. With no sustained rainfall in the region since last November, risotto rice production in the Po Valley, which accounts for about 40% of Italy's agricultural output, is under threat. Growers have warned that up to 60% of the crop may be lost as paddy fields dry out and turn salty, with record low water levels allowing more seawater into the delta. The water crisis is not confined to southern Europe. Water levels have also fallen to dangerous low levels on the Rhine, a vital northwest European waterway used to transport oil, petrol, coal, and other raw materials that connects Germany's industrial heartland to the major ports of Rotterdam and Antwerp in the Netherlands. The river's level on Monday, 8th of August, was already lower than at the same point in 2018, when a severe drought eventually halted goods transport for 132 days. Some vessels are operating at 25% capacity to avoid running aground, driving up freight costs. The drought has hit German waterways just as freight vessels are supposed to carry increased amounts of coal in order to service the power plants that the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has reactivated in the face of Russia throttling deliveries of natural gas to Germany. In the capital Berlin, authorities have recorded falling water levels at the many lakes fed by the River Spree. In the southern city of Nuremberg, dried out urban trees are being watered from municipal indoor swimming pools, closed to save gas. In Switzerland, the dairy industry has been hardest hit. Authorities in Freiburg, Jura and Neuchâtel have had to open valley meadows not usually used for grazing until September, since pastures higher up the mountains were already too dry. Dominique de Boumann, the chairman of Freiburg's cheesemaking cooperative, told Le Temps newspaper that production of cheese and milk was likely to be hit this year. Dominique de Boumann said, "A fall can be predicted and we may even end up with a shortage of Gruyere," he said. In Obwalden canton near Lucerne, the army had to be called in to transport water by helicopter from Lake Sarnen to thirsty cows in the village of Kerns. The Netherlands declared an official water shortage last week. The Dutch government has not yet introduced restrictions on household water consumption, but has asked people to think carefully about whether they need to wash their car or completely fill a paddling pool. In neighboring Belgium, meanwhile, forecasters reported the driest